This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Keith Carradine belongs to a family of actors. His father is John Carradine, his older brother is David, and his younger brother is Robert. And the actress Martha Plimpton is Keith's daughter. Keith Carradine is the kind of actor who seems most at home in offbeat films, playing con men, artists, and womanizers. Robert Altman directed him in Nashville and Thieves Like Us. Alan Rudolph directed him in Choose Me, Trouble in Mind, and The Moderns. And Carradine starred in Louis Malle's film Pretty Baby. But this month, on HBO, you can see Keith Carradine in the kind of role he seldom plays, a sensitive, middle-class family man. Carradine plays the father of a boy who has been sexually molested by their priest. Carradine and his wife press charges and refuse to let the church buy them off. The name of the movie is Judgment. I wanted to know how Carradine's career veered away from the mainstream, making a role like this seem so out of character.
I generally tend to choose roles that are going to take me out of myself. That's where I get off, as a craftsman. The further I can play from my own personality or my own lifestyle or anything like that, the more entertained I am in my work. So maybe that has something to do with it, and the fact that my own life is basically, you know, fairly middle class. I mean, I'm married, I got kids, I have all of the usual attendant concerns, problems, joys of that kind of life.
When you were growing up, how close were you to your father's acting career? How much of, were you ever on the set with him? Were there a lot of acting friends over at the house? Did you feel like this was a big actor family?
Well, it was certainly, I mean, growing up with Pa was, it was distinctive. He was, his personality was very colorful and forceful. But he did not really, I think he tried to keep his children away from being, you know, backstage babies, the notion of having been born in a trunk, you know, in the middle of some road company somewhere. He really wanted us to have normal childhoods. There were occasions when he had acting friends over, but he was not that kind of a social person either. He wasn't a party goer, and I remember one party he gave, and I think it was the only one we ever had there at the house where there were some actor people over there for it. But apart from that, it was really, he tried to give us a really kind of normal home life. As normal as can be expected from, a Shakespearean actor who was as much of a character as he was. We were surrounded by great literature and classical music, and there was an atmosphere of that pervaded our lives simply because that was what interested him. But in terms of, I went to a public school, until I was in senior high school, then I went off to a boarding school, a prep school. But for the most part, I mean, I led a very normal life. He didn't take us on movie sets much.
Because you'd be a bother or because he wanted to just
Well, I think he just wanted us to kept away from it. I think that he wanted us to have normal lives. And I think that he was acutely aware of the influence that it might have on our later career choices if we spent too much time around his world. Maybe it was a reverse psychology because he was certainly delighted that as many of his sons went into acting as did, you know.
It's interesting. Your father, John Carradine, was a classical kind of actor, but he ended up doing zillions of horror films.
He had to make money. He was raising seven boys, which is not cheap.
So what stage of his career was he in during your formative years?
He was doing a lot of the crap when I was growing up. Yeah. He was not real happy about it. You know, I mean, occasionally he would get something that he could sort of enjoy. Once in a while he would mount a theater production and he'd go and do some classical or semi-classical character. And that would, that would renew his energy and his joy in what he, his chosen career. But most of the time he was bringing unexpected luster to some pretty mediocre movies.
Wouldn't you, though, as a kid have been more interested in the horror films than, Shakespeare anyways?
Well, yeah, I suppose there's a certain element of truth in that, but I was acutely aware, by the time I was very young, of what the classics meant, what they were, and I really did know the difference, and, I might even have been a little bit of a snob about it. Certainly by the time I was a teenager, there were things that I simply looked down my nose at because I thought they were so lowbrow.
Like what?
Well, I mean, certain kinds of films, certain kinds of music. I mean, I was very late to come to pop music. I listened much more to classical music, and when I started playing music and playing guitar, I was more of a folky than anything, because I thought that most rock and roll and pop music was banal and mindless, You know, I have come really full circle since those days.
Let me just ask you, I know your father filed for bankruptcy during one point when you were growing up. How did that happen?
Well, he went off to Africa. He had his first really well-paying gig that he'd had in a while. You know, we did not grow up rich.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up culturally rich in my household, but we didn't have a lot of money. And this was during a particularly lean time, and he got a big sort of plum role in this Tarzan movie, and he was getting some good money. And they went off and shot it in Africa. He was playing the heavy, the father of the bad guys. There were like three of them, the father and his two evil sons. Gordon Scott was the handsome, suntanned hero. And when he finished shooting in Africa, he had a stop in London on his way home. And he went into a casino, you know, during the night he was there and managed to gamble away not only his entire salary, but twice his entire salary. I think he might have been getting like $40,000 for the 8 weeks or something, which in those days was a lot of money. And I think he was $80,000 down at one point. And then he managed to get up to where he'd broken even. And by that time, it was 6 a.m. and he left the casino and called my stepmother and told her he'd just gambled away in his entire paycheck. That was the beginning of an interesting phase.
What was the family reaction to this?
We moved.
To a cheaper place, right?
You bet. Well, that didn't strike me as terribly expensive, the place we were in, but I guess it was probably twice the rent. You know, we were living in this big old rambling house with horses, and it was kind of a ranch. And we went from that to a sort of a cracker box tract home, and we all crammed into there. And that was really what life was like for the next 5 to 8 years. That was how we lived. It was very middle class, and in terms of income and material wealth. And that's how it was. I would go after school. I remember we didn't live too far from where we had moved. And I used to get on my bicycle after school and ride over to the old house and just sort of sit there longingly wishing for a return to the good old days.
Right.
Yeah.
Keith Carradine is my guest. You ended up staying with your father after your parents divorced. I think in those days it was really typical for mothers to have custody. How did you end up staying with your father?
Well, it was like the courts basically decided that, he was not as crazy as my mother. And that was the bottom line, you know. They were pretty wild people, but in some ways his wildness was more acceptable and conventional than my mom's. She was pretty much a flower child in the mid-50s. She was way ahead of her time.
Uh-huh. You once told Seventeen magazine that...
God, did I talk to them?
Yeah.
Amazing.
That you thought you were a potential juvenile delinquent without the guts to go in that direction.
Yeah, I suppose that's accurate. Yeah. A lot of things that I said 15 years ago, I would say, my God, did I say that? But I suppose that's a possibility. Well, I had certainly the seeds of rebellion within me. But yeah, I suppose that I lacked the bottle to actually go out and, you know, blatantly break the law or do anything that would have gotten me incarcerated or something.
What were the things in your fantasies that you would have liked to do?
Oh, I don't know. I had friends who were stealing cars and stuff, and I was always sort of appalled that they did it, but I secretly was envious of their courage, you know. You know, my rebellion was more personal.
In what way?
I did things to hurt myself, or at least to put myself in danger. I didn't really endanger anyone else, you know.
What's an example of how you'd put yourself in danger?
Well, the whole late 60s. I mean, I took virtually every drug available, with probably the exception of heroin, you know. I managed to go through that phase and survive it. A lot of people didn't, so I feel very fortunate.
Was that when you were already in Hollywood? You grew up in Hollywood. And, what am I saying?
Well,
but you know what I mean.
I kind of grew up in Hollywood. Yeah. I mean, my grandparents, where I lived a lot of my childhood, they were up north, Northern California and San Francisco. But I was already, yes, I was pursuing a career as an actor during that phase, yeah.
So you were really like one of the hippies in Hollywood, right?
Well, you know, you can say that, but on the other hand, I wasn't really, because I was already into earning money, you know, and
right.
Supposedly being a hippie was not about that. It was about sort of not connecting to that whole trip at all. I mean, there was certainly a phase when, you know, granted, yes, I was making money and paying my rent and all of that, but I refused to have a checking account, I refused to have a credit card. That was my sort of mild form of protest, you know, but I was still plugged into the capitalist machine. I wasn't kidding anybody but myself, I suppose.
Well, still, you had long hair, you were doing psychedelic drugs. I was wondering if that put you, if that typecast you early on into a certain kind of role, or, in, you know, in the way directors or casting directors saw you.
Well, you know, in retrospect, I'm sure it did. At the time, I felt as though I was simply part of what was happening, you know, but I guess... you know, when you've fallen into that kind of a bag, you tend to see yourself as being a part of a larger group than perhaps it really was. I mean, I was probably the only client of my agency, my theatrical agency, who showed up in tank tops, bare feet, and hair down to my chest. Oftentimes I would come into the agency shirtless, you know, which seemed absolutely fine to me. Now that I look back on it, it was probably really shocking to some people, you know. I'm sure that might have influenced, to a certain extent, some of the opportunities I was given in the earlier part of my career.
All right. Keith Carradine is my guest, and he's starring in a new HBO movie called Judgment. Your brother, David, had the same father but a different mother, so you're stepbrothers.
We're half-brothers.
Half-brothers, I mean, right,
yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up with your father, and he grew up with his mother?
Yeah, once his mother and my father separated, David stayed with his mother, yeah.
So did you really know each other very well when you were growing up?
Not really. I mean, I kind of had passing acquaintances with David, who was then Jack. He was born John Arthur, and he was called Jack.
How did he change it to David?
Well, he became David somewhere in the early 60s, I think, at the beginning of his career, when some agent suggested that he go by some other moniker than the old man's name.
Right.
So I'm not even sure how he chose David, but anyhow, that's what he hung on himself. You know, our relationship was really passing. I sort of admired him from afar, because he was always a very dynamic personality, and he would show up for family dinners and things on occasion, you know, and I was always very impressed with him, and I kind of looked up to him. Until finally, when I was striking out on my own, it was actually just before I got out of high school, I went down and looked him up. I was down on a weekend away from boarding school with a couple of friends, and we went down to Hollywood and stayed at one of my friends' homes. And we looked David up one night. And that was really kind of the beginning of our relationship as brothers. And he took me under his wing when I finally moved down to Hollywood. I was struggling along. I was sharing an apartment with a buddy in Venice Beach, and we were cooking Colonel Sanders chicken for a living. Pretty squalid existence. But David came along and took me in and actually supported me for about 6 months. And guided me into my, you know, my initial, you know, halting steps as an actor.
Were you ever up for the same roles early on?
We still are on occasion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's very bizarre. I mean, you wouldn't think we would ever be, but we were both up for Bound for Glory. We were both up for the role of Woody Guthrie.
He got it.
He got it. We were both up for the role in Pretty Baby. I got that one.
So, oh,
you know,
really?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting. There is great competition in this business. And to be in competition with your own family for the same part is kind of an odd thing, but it's a wonderful thing, because if ever I was going to lose a part to somebody, I would certainly rather lose it to David than some guy that I don't know.
Right.
You know, we have great love for each other, and our competition is loving and supportive, you know, if there is any.
I have to ask you, you know his TV series Kung Fu?
Yeah, I know that one.
Yeah. There's a shot of you, isn't there? You know the opening sequence?
Yes, I did the pilot.
Oh, okay.
I did the pilot, and I played the middle Kane. So I was supposed to be David at age, like, 18 or 20 or something like that.
Oh, that's you.
That's me.
You know where I recognize you? There's a shot in the opening sequence.
Yes.
In the temple, and you're one of the students, is that the right word?
That's right. Well, it's supposed to be sort of
a
chronological documentation of the growth of this character. See, you see him as a young child, then you see him as a teenager, which is me, and then finally it's David, the full-fledged, full-blown grasshopper. But David invited me. He asked me to come do the pilot. I was already, you know, I was enjoying some wonderful success in my career at that point. And to me, it certainly wasn't something that I needed in terms of my career, but it was an opportunity to take part in a kind of, in some way, a family project, you know. So they had me come over and I did the pilot. And then they used footage from that bit that I did for all the 3 years. They kept using that footage.
I see.
Every once in a while, I'd get a check for $14, you know, from whatever network it was, or whatever production company it was. Warner Brothers, I guess.
Well, you did one movie with your brothers David and Robert.
Yeah.
And that was The Long Riders, directed by Walter Hill. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful film, and there's two other sets of brothers in it.
The three, actually.
The Quaids.
The Quaids, the Keaches, and the Guests.
That's right, the Guests, that's right.
Yeah, Christopher and Nicholas Guest, yeah.
Right. So was it fun to have three brothers in the same film?
It was a gas. I can't tell you how much fun it was. We had a ball. It was a kid's dream come true. just to be able to get up every morning and put on a duster and a six gun and get on a horse and go out and ride and shoot and hoot and holler, you know. I mean, and get paid for that? I mean, it's unbelievable. It was like summer camp. And it was just a wonderful group, and there was a great kind of energy and spirit to the whole endeavor. It was a 12-week shoot that went on for 16 weeks because of weather problems and other things. And, you know, when you get to the end of a 16-week shoot, ordinarily you've had it. You cannot wait to get home, and you cannot wait to see the last of all those people you've been confronted with on a daily basis. But in this particular case, we were having so much fun that I don't think there's a man on that picture who wouldn't have gone on another 16 weeks gladly. I mean, mm-hmm. It was just a terrific experience.
I think the first movie that you were really noticed in was Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you played a real cad and then got to sing this really sensitive folk song, I'm Easy, which you wrote.
Yeah.
This is a movie where a lot of the actors were asked to write their own songs for it.
Mm-hmm.
That song won an Academy Award.
Yes.
And you recorded a couple albums and had a small career as a singer afterwards. How serious were you about your singing career then?
Well, I was serious about it. It was always a secondary pursuit of mine. The only reason I had a singing career was because of my movie career. The sales of my first record were quite wonderful because of the success of I'm Easy. My second record, which I thought was far superior artistically, didn't sell at all. And that was kind of disillusioning, you know.
How did you start working with Robert Altman?
I walked into his office when he was going to do McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And, you know, it's a part of this young cowboy who comes up to use the whorehouse in the town of Presbyterian Church. And David's then agent and manager, a fellow named Saul Krugman, who's now gone, knew about the project and knew about this role and thought I'd be very right for it. And he arranged for me to meet with initially the producers and then with Mr. Altman. And I had my hair was about 2 feet long when I met Bob. And I walked into his apartment office in Westwood. And it was one of the most bizarre meetings I've ever had. I wish they were all like that. Because usually they sit you down and they intimidate you and then they see how well you hold up, you know. But with Bob, it was so real and it had nothing to do with any of that stuff. It had to do with just who you were and how you behaved, because that's the way he casts. He casts behavior. And he saw this kid walk into his office, and I think he probably knew within 15 or 20 seconds that he wanted me to play the part. But he was unwrapping this package that had been sent to him from Colombia. He'd been down there at the Cartagena Film Festival or something, and he came back with some pre-Columbian art, and he was unwrapping this parcel and showing it to me. I think, as I remember, it was a stone angel or something. And he said, well, we're going to do this movie up there. He says, I don't know about the hair. Well, maybe we can use it like it is. He says, it's not much of a part, but if you want to do it, you know, you want to do it? I said, well, yeah, sure. And that was it. I mean, there was no reading. There was no, you know, none of that stuff. He took a look at me and said, yeah, come on up.
There's another movie I want to ask you about. That's Pretty Baby, in which you played a photographer who's taken with a young girl who's growing up in a whorehouse and who becomes the photographer's model. And this was directed by Louis Malle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you played opposite the very young Brooke Shields. I mean, this is the role that launched her career. She was, what, 11 or 12?
She was 11 when we shot the picture. She turned 12 the last week of shooting.
What was it like working opposite the 11-year-old Brooke Shields? I mean, it was a very demanding role because she had to play very mature.
She had to play very mature, and which was to rationally approach an 11-year-old girl with romance on your mind is impossible. Coming from the place of being a 26-year-old man, which is what I was at that point. The trick that I had to do in my head in order to make that work was to, rather than try to bring her to my level, was to simply reduce myself to the emotional level and remember what it felt like when I was 11 and when I had a crush on a girl in school. And that was really what I had to become in order to play that part, was in terms of my relationship with her, I had to go to the emotional level of 11 or 12 years old and simply remember myself at that point. Otherwise, it would have been impossible. I couldn't have dealt with it.
That's an interesting way of handling it.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a man with a child. It was a boy with a child from the point of view of we were contemporaries.
Do you have to make movies to make a living?
Yeah.
You do? Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Are you asking me if I'm independently wealthy?
Well, I got the feeling from the stories about your father that you probably weren't, but I never know when an actor's made enough money to be able to, you know, live off of.
Oh, please. Nowhere close. I mean, I wish that I could take some time off sometimes. I don't get enough time with my wife and kids. My work takes me away from home, you know. I mean, I've actually considered doing a television series on occasion just because it would keep me in Los Angeles and keep me around my family, but something just won't let me make that leap yet.
So how do you think your career divides between movies you feel you have to do and movies that you really want to do?
It's about 50-50, which makes me pretty fortunate in the overall, you know, scope of things. I get to do about half what I can feel passionate about and about half what I have to do to pay the bills, you know. Fortunately, the stuff that I do to pay the bills is still worthwhile stuff, you know. But it's difficult to get people to pay you, you know, a substantial salary to do something that has very little possibility of achieving any kind of commercial success. It just doesn't work that way. So, you know, the films that Alan and I do together, we never really got paid for. I mean, not much. So I will go off and I will do mainstream, middle-of-the-road television and things like that and, you know, make the money I need to make to be able to subsidize, you know, my career as an actor in art films.
Right. Do you have any other films coming out that you'd like us to know about?
Well, I did a film in Europe that no one may ever know about, called The Bachelor, which I have been screening on my own, trying to get an American distribution, which is, I feel like Sisyphus and his rock, you know, I keep pushing this thing towards the top of the mountain and something always happens and it goes dribbling back down again. And it's quite a wonderful film. It's just, it's very European, and the marketplace nowadays has very little room for this kind of movie. But it's quite a beautiful film. I screened it here in New York City last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and for you know, a possible distributor. I'm afraid nothing's going to come of that because the person is a fool. But the audience were very intelligent and, in fact, saw the film for what it is, which is brilliant.
Any chance of a movie in the near future reuniting you with your brothers David and Robert?
There's always the chance. So we just have to find the right vehicle. You know, it's difficult for us to appear in a film together because people are so aware of the fact that we're related. So for us to play unrelated people would be difficult for an audience to accept. So I think that we have to find something where we can play family for it really to work.
Don't you have a brother who's not an actor?
Yeah, I got a few, actually.
Oh, that's right. You said there were seven when you were...
Well, there are eight of us all together, varying degrees of brotherhood. Yeah, no sisters.
Right.
And my father said he could always make women, but he could never produce them.
Well, Keith Carradine, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Actor Keith Carradine, he stars in the HBO movie Judgment, which premieres October 13th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.